Okay, good morning, everyone. That's not bad, actually. If you do that at 9 o'clock, the 9 o'clock session is really weak, but well done. Good morning. Thanks for joining us. Session moved from Exchange 2007 to Modern Exchange. My name is Greg Taylor. I'm a program manager in the Office 365 customer experience team. My team focuses on Exchange. So my team produces things like the mailbox role calculator and a bunch of guidance for a whole bunch of other stuff. So we have a fairly broad-ranging task. And Steve?
So I'm Steve Kahn. I'm the Senior Product Marketing Manager at Microsoft in the Office 365 group as well. And I am the Exchange Server Marketing team. So I can't travel, with myself on a plane, isn't that it? The team can't travel all at once.
Well, that's what they tell you. Yeah. Good. There's always a classic joke that I should know. I'm a program manager, and Steve is
a product manager.
And the difference between a program manager and a product manager is a program manager knows when he's lying. So anyway, so just a level set here. So how many of you are on Exchange 2007? How many of you are running Exchange? That is terrific. Great, because if not a single hand went up, I was going to suggest you might want to go to Tony's session on groups or something like that. So what we're going to cover in this session is...
Should we check other versions?
We should. Yeah. I mean, newer versions. I'll tell you what, older than 2007. Awesome. Check it out. 2003 or older? Older? 2003. All right. We still have 5.5 running on some customers' sites. I can tell you that is true. So basically our concept here is Steve's going to cover the why you might want to move from Exchange 2007. Hopefully you're interested in getting off 2007, which is why you're here. I'm going to focus on how you get from 2007. The thing you should know, we're talking a level 200 kind of session here, so we're not going to go into great technical detail. It's more about why you want to do it and how you go about doing it at a pretty high level. So I hope that works. I'm going to hand over to Steve, and then I will come back and do the why, or the how, rather.
Excellent.
Just a bit. Okay.
Thank you, Greg. And we just said 2007. Some of these concepts actually apply to 2010 as well. So any folks on 2010 or have some in your environment? Okay, so we've got most of the room covered here. Clearly, marketing is falling down on getting people to upgrade to new versions. So let's get on those guys, okay? The thing that we're talking about, why we said 2007 specifically in the title, is a coexistence thing, right? Exchange 2007 can coexist with what? 2010, yeah, and 2013. How about 2016? No. 2010, what can it coexist with? 2013 and 2016. If you don't have 2016, it can be the middle part of it, 2007, 2010, 2013. But if you don't have 2007, then all the way up to 16. So we explicitly wanted to call out 2007 in the title to make sure that we cover those people that, 2016 isn't currently an option because you couldn't deploy it. But also some of the stuff will be valid for 2010 as well. So why are we here? Greg covered it a little bit at a high level, but let's drill a little bit deeper, right? Why are we here? Well, clearly we have proven here today there is a non-zero population of people who still have some 2007 in your environment. You may not be 100% 2007, maybe a mixture, but at least some 2007. Right? Despite what the conspiracy theorists might have you think, for on-premises Exchange, we do not get telemetry. We cannot tell exactly how many mailboxes are running exactly what version. Right? We do some third-party investigation. We use probably the same analysts and research firms that you all do to collect data. We definitely know when a 2007 customer calls customer support or Premier, right? We definitely can identify those customers. But just kind of, rule of thumb, like rough order of magnitude, we know that there is some, like in a low double digits amount of mailboxes running on Exchange 2007. So that's one reason that we're here, and you've all shown that we've proved that point. But hey, it's still working. SMTP really hasn't changed very much over 20 or even 25, 30 years, right? So if the users are still sending email and getting email, the servers are still running, right? Why bother? It's a valid point. We've clearly chosen or proved that the economic value of investing in Exchange 2007 was wise, right? Well, a couple of reasons. If you're familiar with our 5+5 support policy, for the first 5 years of a product, we roll in new features. And not 100% of the time can we do that. There are some technical limitations, but by and large, new features come to versions for 5 years. For the next 5 years, we go into what's called extended support, which means bug fixes, security fixes, some basic, you know, usability broken sort of fixes, but no new features. So at best, if you're on Exchange 2007, you haven't seen anything new from an admin standpoint or a user standpoint for 4.5 years, right? A couple things have changed since then, haven't they? If we think back to 2007, right? There was a launch of this product called the iPhone. That's changed a little bit in 10 years, right? We're on iOS 7 and we're on the actual hardware version 7. The Exchange ActiveSync protocol that underlies that connectivity to Exchange has radically changed, both on the client side and the server side, right? Android was on, if my memory serves me right, Bagel in 2007. What are we on, like Red Velvet Cake or something now, right? Android has changed quite radically. There has been the rise of this phenomenon called the tablet, right? iPads, the underlying iOS for that as well. Android tablets, the underlying Android OS. Windows, we've had a few changes. We were rocking Windows Vista and Outlook 2007, right? We've had a few changes there. Windows 8, 8.1, 10, and several versions of Outlook. Mac was running like, you know, Bobcat or something back then. It's, you know, some, what is it, Snow Leopard, Spotted Leopard. So it's hard for me to keep track. We were running Entourage for Mac. Right? It took us a long time, but we finally got to Outlook for Mac and have Outlook 2016 for Mac. So huge amount of changes from the client side. Right? None of that really reflected on the server side. So that's something to think about. Once we hit April, there are no fixes, period, for Exchange 2007. And part of that is that other than Greg, there are very few people around that know how to actually code for Exchange 2007. That's part of it. Another one is just the length of time, right? The underlying OS, the Windows Server 2008 OS versus 2012, 2012 R2, 2016. Right? Even the code base that we're running under, some of the APIs that we use and things are going out of support. Well, still, you know, it's running. It's not like Microsoft can turn off those servers in April 2017. It's still gonna work. You might be surprised at some of the things that will bite you. We had a time zone change. Believe it or not, countries change the time zone that they think they should be in, or when daylight savings time stops and starts, and that has an impact on calendar items and timestamps for emails and that kind of stuff. We had one just this summer. Chile changed when daylight savings time starts. So we issued a fix to update for that. Unfortunately, we changed the actual start time of the daylight savings time. We forgot to change the little user string that tells the user what time zone they're in. So the users all thought things were wrong, so we had to kind of refix that one. But even something as simple as that, right, stops happening in April 2017. Greg may hit on this as well, but the actual hardware, if you think about the hardware you were buying 10 years ago, we're having a real challenge getting Exchange 2007 to run on newer hardware. It's just not built. It's not optimized down to the kind of the disk and the metal layer to run on today's hardware. Well, let's continue traveling back in time to Exchange 2007. Here's some stuff that we built in 2007 that's really stood the test of time, concepts that have been really useful. We switched, no longer supporting 32-bit hardware, 64-bit only, right? So a huge increase in memory that we could deal with and IOPS to and from disk. It was great for larger disk support and larger databases support. We also introduced this concept of the edge server. wow, so I don't have to have a member server of my domain in my DMZ. That seems like a good idea, doesn't it? And that's proven out pretty well over time. Come on here. There we go. Auto-discover. Do you remember having to type the FQDN of your Exchange ActiveSync or Client Access or front-end server into the little keyboard to make it work for ActiveSync, right? And heaven help you if you mistyped that, or heaven help you if you changed that FQDN at some point. There's also a little bit about making it easier for the Outlook client to connect up, all right, with AutoDiscover. So that was a pretty good thing. Resource mailboxes. So you have a projector, you have a meeting room or such, and you want to make it bookable by users. Do you remember how you had to do that before 2007? You create a user mailbox, because that's all we had was user mailboxes. And then you went in and played with permissions and ACLs so that everybody could access it. Right? Resource mailbox, that's a good idea, and it's lasted. Message retention policy, this is probably self-explanatory. And a whole bunch of things having to do with high availability. Active-active clustering sounded really cool, and we sold a whole bunch of Windows licenses that way, but we did a much better job of high availability, resiliency, replication, et cetera, in Exchange 2007. And last but not least, for the end user, we had something too. Different versions of OOF. So you could have an OOF that was internal and an OOF that was external. Right? Wow, amazing. But guess what? We have done some work on these features, these exact features, over time. As a matter of fact, we've done a lot of work. Greg is the king of auto-discover, so if you need anything or anything, please contact Greg. I'll give you his email address later. Oh, I wasn't supposed to. Oh, sorry about that. Yeah, we've done a huge amount of work in these features. They no longer resemble what they did before if you look at the underlying code base. So we've done a lot of work here. Now, for those of you who went to Exchange 2010, you saw some additional stuff. We made a lot of changes in the store schema and the extensible storage engine, right? The old JET database lives on. We did a huge amount of changes to make IOPS about 70% less, right? So not only support for bigger disks, but a much better performing infrastructure. We introduced this concept of role-based administrator. All right, so you didn't have to give everybody keys to the kingdoms. You could have some people creating user mailboxes, and those people could not do things like change transport rules. Right? Pretty useful concept. We had this idea of OWA mailbox policies. So you would no longer have to go in and change virtual directories in IIS for Outlook Web Access or Outlook Web App. Right, you could just go in and change some mailbox policies. Super useful. You could control access to mailboxes by device type. You could say, hey, if somebody is running X version of device, I want to allow that, X and above. Or I want to block people who are on older versions of ActiveSync, older versions of devices. Or quarantine, I want to take a look at who's trying to connect and see if I think that device type is okay. Or if the device belongs to the CEO, and then I'll just let it in anyway, right? We had support for hybrid connectivity. I probably could have just had this one bullet, right? The old, what started out as BPOS, Microsoft hosting Exchange servers in its own cloud, right? And it wasn't 2007 per se, it was Service Pack 1, but with 2010, you could connect, sorry, I said 2007, didn't I? 2010, Service Pack 1, you could connect your on-premises infrastructure to your online tenant, and have them act in a federated fashion, look to users as if they were one organization for free busy, for mail routing, all kinds of useful stuff. Right? Pretty big deal. Really related to point number one there, we made a change from recommending RAID to recommending JBOD, just a bunch of disks. And we actually, two things, so we got that from our changes to the store and Easy. We also got that from experience of running our own server infrastructure, right? So a lot easier, a lot less complex, a lot less expensive storage. If you're an end user, you weren't left out. this concept of federated delegation, so we could be in two different organizations but share free busy information. Share calendars, allow delegate access for calendars. This is really useful for mergers, acquisitions, that kind of stuff. Right? Mail tips, the little annoying thing that says, please don't send that email, right? There's a blank subject line, or you're sending to a distribution list that has 6,000 participants, or you're sending to somebody outside your organization. Support for conversation views, so this thing that we introduced in Outlook for the desktop, bringing that to Outlook Web Access. And then, wow, this was just so phenomenal. I had to put this one in. You could actually see if somebody had replied to the email, right on your mobile device. Amazing. And, okay, we didn't do a whole lot more for the end user in Exchange 2010. A lot of this started becoming client-side work. Right, this is around the time that the Outlook team and the Exchange team once again joined together. They had been, you know, in kind of a legal separation trial. They decided not to get divorced. They got back together, and all was well. You know, had you upgraded to Exchange 2013? You'd see some changes as well. We introduced 5 server roles. Exchange 2007, we thought that was a great idea. Really, you know, discrete edge and hub transport and client access. From running our own infrastructure, we figured out that really just didn't buy us a whole lot. So we reduced it down to 3 server roles. So if you went to Exchange 2013, right, you could kind of collapse some infrastructure, get better utilization of your hardware, that sort of thing. We no longer needed session affinity, so your client access server and your mailbox server before had to have session affinity. So, you know, God help you if that client access server got too busy, couldn't respond, went offline, et cetera. We reduced that, actually eliminated that in Exchange 2013. So any CAS could serve any mailbox on any mailbox server, right? Makes it really easy to do load balancing. I know we sometimes look askance at load balancing, but it becomes possible in Exchange 2013. Public folders. You'll see public folders a couple of times here through the slides. You know, as many times as we've tried to kill them, right? Just like Keith Richards, they keep coming back over and over again, right? And we're actually investing in public folders again. You'll see some of that here in a slide or two. But we had not done anything for public folders pretty much since the launch of Exchange. We actually changed the underlying database to use the mailbox architecture, which meant all this cool stuff we were building, like distributed access groups, could now work for public folders and not just for mailboxes. We changed the MAPI over RPC. We like to change the name of this, right? Outlook Anywhere, or Outlook over the internet, Outlook across the web, Outlook over SSL. Right. Whatever, it was all encapsulated RPC, tends to be a bit chatty, doesn't always react well to dropped packets or congested networks, that kind of thing. So we changed that to just industry standard HTTPS. Okay, it's still chatty, but it's not as chatty as it was. Yes, it's still less than indestructible, but it's more resilient, more able to handle dropped packets. The other thing is, too, if you have a bunch of hops between the Outlook client and the Exchange infrastructure, right, much less likely that some step along the way is going to munge the packets because it just looks like encrypted HTTP. We reduced the namespaces. We kind of figured out that maybe 8 namespaces was a bit much, right, a little difficult to handle. So we reduced it down to 2 with Exchange 2013. All right, which means if you have a merger, if you have an acquisition, et cetera, a lot easier to manage namespaces. We had a concept of hold earlier, and it was either hold everything or hold nothing. With Exchange 2013, we introduced the concept of in-place hold, so you could have a little flexibility. You could say, I want to hold something for X number of days and have it on a rolling basis. Or a certain type, a certain folder in the mailbox, or a certain type of email we wanted to retain and not the others. DLP, right, this could be a big one, data loss prevention. Recognizing certain information should not be sent outside the organization, right? Sensitive data, so preventing information leaks. And then a bunch of stuff on high availability. Again, you can see that kind of over and over. As we run our own infrastructure over the years, we learn more and more about what not to do and changes that make things more resilient and easier to operate. And those accrue to on-premises exchange. Right? One of my favorite things was when they changed the who does the red bat phone ring from some poor engineer sitting in a data center like, oh, crap, the store crashed, what am I going to do, to the actual engineers writing the code. Right? And it's amazing how much of this self-healing, resilient, easy managed availability sort of stuff started appearing in Exchange Online and accrued down to Exchange On-Premises when it was, you know, Joe Engineer in Redmond who got the call from our CVP, Rajesh Jha, not really Rajesh, it's recording, basically said, I should probably paraphrase that, your stuff has broken. Would you please remote in and fix it? Is that about right? Yeah, okay, pretty close. And then for the end user, they got some stuff as well. We did a ton of work in Outlook Web Access, right? It seems like it's amazing it's only been 3 years ago, but the explosion of people using browsers to do stuff instead of apps, right? Remember that thing where it was like, oh, apps, 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 it's all about apps for mobile phones and tablets, and then it became, nobody's gonna use apps anymore, it's all browser. Nobody needs to use an app for anything. Well, reflected here, right? We did a ton of work in Outlook Web Access to say it's not just a PC or a laptop, it's not just Internet Explorer that might be accessing the mailbox. It could be a smartphone, it could be a tablet, it could be coming from Chrome or Firefox or Safari. We need to have an OA experience that recognizes the incoming browser type and formats appropriately. Okay. We also added in support for apps or add-ins in Outlook Web Access. We had these for years in Outlook, right? Even the old Calm add-in days. Right? Porting those over, making them available for Outlook Web Access as well. Contact linking, that's something that we just all do from our phones all the time. It showed up for the first time here in Outlook Web Access in Exchange 2013. Merged calendars, this one is pretty cool if you've got right your corporate calendar, but a personal calendar, and maybe a team calendar and stuff, being able to look at those all in one view. Again, it sounds like table stakes. This was brand new in 2013, the ability to actually have a single calendar with all these different calendar types represented in it. And then add-ins being able to work in a new message. Wow, right? Add-ins up until this point only were in the body or only acted on the body of a received message. To actually be able to start a compose and have an add-in, like for Salesforce or Dynamics or such, be able to recognize what you were doing and jump in and assist was brand new for 2013. And for those of you who have gone to Exchange 2016, right? For both the IT pro and the end user, all the new stuff that we've introduced is nothing. Exchange 2016 is precisely the same code as 2013. We just changed the label. They're not buying it. Just kidding. We actually have done some work over the last 3 years as well. And these things, again, will mainly accrue from Exchange Online. So a couple things for the IT pro, right? We've now gone down to two server roles, one of which is edge transport. So single server that handled everything, and then front end to back end to handle client protocols, and then edge and hub transport and routing, and then back down to back. Yeah, we're back down to one. Mailboxes and protocols on the same server. And again, this is something we learned from running our own infrastructure. The CAS arrays can just get pounded with all these mobile devices trying to access and stay up to date all the time. It's so much more performant if the protocols and the mailboxes are co-located. So sorry about this whole server role thing. We meant well, it was a good idea at the time, but that's changed now. Public folder mailboxes. I mentioned we had made some investments here, right? There was a limit of 100 public folder mailboxes to house public folders. And right, for most of you, you say, so isn't 100 seems like a lot, right? Well, if you are a big organization, you're geographically dispersed, you have a lot of remote locations, The people in those remote locations who are accessing public folder content could have a less than desirable experience. Because you're limited to 100, they might have to go across some pretty spotty network coverage and bandwidth constriction to get to the public folder information. So if you're doing things like workflows, right, expense report processing, that kind of stuff, public folders can be a big deal. So having 1,000 public folder mailboxes, you can be really, really discreet and have public folder mailboxes homed in small locations, remote locations. I see a couple nods over here. So this can be a big deal. 2016 mailbox servers can support 2013 client access servers, right? So why is that a big deal? Well, that's a big deal because in the past, if the mailbox was on a higher version of Exchange than the CAS, it didn't work, did it? With Exchange 2016, you can upgrade the mailboxes and leave the CAS the way they are, right? And then come back and update the CAS later. It makes it easier to do to broader deployments. In-place e-discovery and hold for public folders. Again, right, the public folder thing. I guess we're gonna have a hard time killing those off if we keep making investments in the engineering, huh? So, hey, if you're doing compliance, you're doing e-discovery, you're doing legal hold on mailboxes, how about on those public folders too? Right, so we've got support for that. I've got a couple numbers up here for the number of mailboxes you can do in a discovery surge. Right, was 5,000, it's really 10,000, but you can run multiple instances of search at the same time, so it becomes unlimited, the number of mailboxes. If you have a big organization, a large number of mailboxes, not having to do a bunch of smaller sequential searches is pretty cool. 30 new sensitive data fingerprint types or document types for data loss prevention. And another DLP integration with SharePoint. Right? And you say, well, gee, how does that affect email? Right? If people are emailing attachments around, that all lives in Exchange. It has nothing to do with SharePoint. I'm going to show you a demo of something that we like to call internally Cloudy Docs, the document collaboration. So I'll save that point and go into it a little bit more during the demo. We did a lot of work, this great work on resiliency and having multiple copies of your databases scattered around geographically could tend to be a little bit chatty. When we made users do a search, it was always against the active copy of the database. Indexes were always done against the active copy. So we've enabled in the latest cumulative update for Exchange 2016 for that work to happen on passive copies of the database, so saving some bandwidth depending on your users and indexes. And then a bunch of stuff on automatically detecting database corruptions and recovering from them. Again, that having that red bat phone that rings in the engineer's house instead of, you know, some poor guy in the data center, that's exactly where that comes from, is having the database realize that it is corrupted, fail over to another one, and then automatically recover. And then for the end user, again, document collaboration, I'm not going to go into this one because I'll show you a demo, but I wanted to have it here in the slides for people who might be viewing this later. It seems like people send around stuff from the web, right? URLs and videos. It's not just all cat videos from YouTube. There's actually some useful stuff. So the idea that I don't have to see this URL, click it, go out to my browser to see what it was all about, and then come back to the email and see what I was supposed to do with that link, but actually have it preview right in the body of the email message, that's pretty cool, right? You don't have to context switch. You see what's going on right there. Or a video. Greg and I have been working on a video together, and I shouldn't say it that way. It sounds kind of questionable. We have been collaborating on a video. And being able to actually preview it right in the body of the email and see what the, hey, is the sound level right? Do we have the right transitions? Right there, oh yeah, I can actually see the preview right in the body of the email and type my response. That's pretty useful. REST APIs, right? So a lightweight, fast, easy programmatic access to calendar information, contact information, email information. A lot of people still love to access mailboxes with an app and Mappy. Right, REST, much easier way to do that. Integration with Skype for Business, so the, you know, start a meeting right from your Outlook client, that sort of thing, much easier. Search, here's another show of hands. We found out, and this is based on telemetry from Exchange Online, that there was a number, a percent, of times that a person would start a search in Outlook on the desktop, and a certain percentage of times, those people would recreate the search within a minute from Outlook on the web. But you want to guess what that number was? 30%, wow. See, I was thinking this might take a little longer than that. Anybody want to guess something more like 33%? Yes, the answer is 33%. So about 33% of the time, a third of the time, people would recreate a search. Why would anyone do that to themselves? Maybe because the search results they got back the first time were incomplete, or they just took too long. Right? Let's think about how this works. The Outlook desktop, in almost all cases, is looking at a cached copy of the mailbox. And the cache size is based on user settings, right? How much mail do I want to retain? It's based on the size of available disk, right? With Outlook 2016, we actually got smart and said we shouldn't put a 50 gig mailbox on a device that has 16 gigs of storage space, right? Seems to make sense. It could be a fantastic machine, maybe a quad core machine with 4 gigs of RAM, right? Sounds pretty impressive. Compare that to Outlook on the web. That search is not done on the client. That's done in Exchange Online. That's done with a significantly greater number of cores and something around 96 gigs of RAM. And it's looking at the entire mailbox, right? By definition, the server holds the entire mailbox. So the search results are faster with Outlook on the web, and they're more complete with Outlook on the web. So, gee, we thought if users are doing this anyway, wouldn't it make sense if we just kind of built things to work that way out of the box? So with Exchange 2016, taking that learning from Exchange Online, applying it to 2016 and Outlook 2016, when you're doing a search, you're sending just a little bit of keystrokes to the server. The server is actually instituting the search and spitting the results down to you, which means you have a more complete search and it's a lot faster. In fact, it lets us do the fuzzy matching. So I start typing in G in my from field, and it could be Greg or Gail or Gertrude or whatever. As I put a GR, then it's just, you know, Greg or Gretchen, et cetera, and on we go, right? So taking this learning, what we got from the telemetry, and saying, yeah, that makes sense. We should change the way search works. And then things like adding events from email. So we all, well, almost all of us flew here. We all got an email from an airline, or just automatically saying, I'm just going to add that to your calendar for you. So you have it blocked out in your schedule. You have a reminder that pops up, all that good stuff. And then if we look at Exchange Online, because that's a viable alternative path you might have gone to for Exchange Online. Oops, here we go. Basically, all that stuff for the administrator accrues. There's some more stuff I'll show you here, too. But also a bunch of stuff that happens for the end user. The focused inbox. Those of you who have Outlook on iOS or Outlook on Android, you've seen this for a while. The ability to say, have the client determine, based on your usage patterns, these emails from these people with this subject line, you always look at. These other ones, you don't. So with a quick swipe, I can say, here's my important email, swipe. Here's the stuff that I don't care about as much. We've brought that to all the flavors of Outlook. Desktop, Mac, web, universal, et cetera. We've changed from Amazon Web Services as a host for the app to Azure, right? No aspersions cast toward Amazon. They're a great local company for us, but we kind of feel better if the data's in Azure. We can protect it a little bit better. And then we're changing the way the machine learning is done from the client side to the server side. This great set of telemetry we've got on user action. So it's not just the focus inbox from your iPhone, right? If you're using desktop, the learning that happens on the desktop that's actually done in the server applies to the iPhone, et cetera. Zero-day auto purge. I'm going to show you some of this other stuff, so I'll just talk about that one. I call it time travel because zero-day auto purge seems a little bit wonky to me. All right, this is the concept of I get an email from Greg. It's a perfectly safe link. It passes my malware checks and such, drops in my inbox. A week later, that site gets compromised. Exchange Online will actually reach into my mailbox, extract that message, rewrite to a safe link, and put it back into my mailbox. It's pretty cool, too. Rather than just talk through these other folks here, why don't we just go in and take a look at a demo? I'll switch over to this machine. Here we go. So here is my Exchange Online tenant. We'll talk through a couple things. I mentioned Cloudy Docs, or document collaboration, right? This is a way for SharePoint and Exchange to work together to help users do the right thing, right? Greg and I could have emailed this slide deck back and forth 100 times, and we have 100 different copies of it in both of our mailboxes, taking up space, versioning is a challenge, right? We could use SharePoint to house the document, this great versioning history and rolling back changes and such, but then I have to give Greg access to the document. I have to remember to go into SharePoint and grant it or my OneDrive for Business. Right? With document collaboration, we've kind of fixed that approach. If you can see those attachments there, look like Word documents with a tiny little cloud on them. Right? What that means is those are not actually attachments. That's a link to that document in the SharePoint Online or the OneDrive for Business document library with a token that grants access to the people on the to line. So I don't have to go in and play with my SharePoint document library. Exchange and SharePoint do that for me, right? So if I create a new email here from Sarah, let's see, I'll send it to, whoops, my type cover died, so I'm gonna be doing these demos just from the touchscreen. So they may be a little less elaborate than they would have been otherwise. All right, attach a file. All these things that have clouds on them mean that they're not actually on my computer. They're just going to the SharePoint library or the OneDrive for Business library. Right? So I send this to Molly. She gets it. She can access it. I've given her full rights here. I can actually change the permissions if I just wanted to have read access, for example. I could do this before, sure, since Exchange 2007 and SharePoint, right? I could go in and grant her access and then copy a link and send it to her. This is easy. I don't have to actually do that. I just send her the document and it happens automatically. If the document's stored on my local hard drive, then Outlook's going to say, hey, do you want to upload this to SharePoint? Make it accessible. Well, sure, all I have to do is click OK, right? So some pretty cool stuff for making collaboration easier for folks. I'll go ahead and get out of that. Another thing that's kind of amazing is the concept of groups. And I had in the slide there, you know, DLs plus, basically. So distribution lists still work. You can still create them. You can still use them. But then if you're the Exchange person, you have to actually create the distribution list, right? And if somebody leaves the company, you've got to change the owner of the distribution list. And you have to figure out how many distribution lists have not been touched in years. I need to go in and clean them up, right? It's a very manual process for the administrator. With the latest and greatest here, I've got the concept of groups, right? So if I click on a group, it's a distribution list. Let me actually create one here for you. And I can kind of show you how this works in detail. In fact, I will actually switch to Outlook on the web to do that. Here's my groups. Got this little new column here. I'm going to create a group. Let me raise the visibility here just a bit. Might be a little bit easier to see. So I choose a name. Again, I'm not going to type a whole lot because the whole touch keyboard here. It's just an email address, so it checks and says, yeah, there's no other email address like that in my tenant. I can put in a description. These are by default, they're searchable, so anybody in the organization can search for this group. Something really descriptive. Privacy, by default, I mentioned, public, open, discoverable. If this is something that shouldn't be discovered by people in my organization, right? It's about a merger, it's the budget for raises for this year, et cetera, I can mark it as private, and then I, as the group owner, have to approve people to be members, to add themselves. If it's public, anyone can join, anyone can leave at their leisure. Right? So I create the group. Great, there's my group. I can add member to the group. And this is me, I'm just a user here. I'm not an administrator. I have no admin access to this facility. Add a member. Start typing out here. There's Sarah. Whoops. I add her, and she's a member. So the cool part of this is a shared mailbox. Anybody who's a member of this group has access to the shared mailbox. I, as the user, can add people. People can add themselves. People can leave. Right? One of the downfalls of DL, a DL is just a number of pointers to mailboxes, right? So if I was not a member of the DL yesterday, I don't see any email that was sent to that DL yesterday. A group is a historical record. It's just a shared inbox. So somebody adds into the group tomorrow, they see everything that's ever happened with this group, all the conversations that happened. Right? I didn't have to ask an Exchange admin to create this for me. I could do it myself. It's got a shared calendar.
Yeah. It's only a feature of online.
So the question is it only a feature of online? Groups is an Azure Active Directory artifact, so it only exists in Exchange Online. Shared file depository, or repository, so this, I don't have to contact my SharePoint admin and ask to have a group created, or a SharePoint document library. It's just right there for me. So some pretty cool stuff that we've done for end users, for IT pros. If we had more time, I could show you some stuff we've done in the Compliance Center, how you actually manage DLP and that sort of thing. But I want to make sure I leave time for Mr. Taylor to tell you how to get here. So.
All right. Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome.
Okay. And everyone's still with us. Brilliant. All right. So there's a ton of good stuff in newer versions of Exchange, whether it's 2010, 13, 16, or online. But what if you don't care? You know, What if all of the document collaboration stuff, the cloudy docs and these kind of things, what if, frankly, you don't care because email is just email, right? There are also a whole bunch of other reasons why you might want to get off Exchange 2007, and a few are listed here. So, you know, Steve mentioned that our support lifecycle of the product has come to an end. There will be no more security fixes, no more time zone fixes. We also have the issue with compatibility with versions. So, if you're an Exchange 2007 mailbox user, but you decide to update Office on the clients because that's a different team or whatever it may be, or you move to click to run for the Office version, and we've actually seen this with customers where they update Office to Exchange to Office 2016, the click to run automatic update stuff, and Office 2016, Outlook 2016 can't connect to an Exchange 2007 mailbox, so connectivity stops. That could be a problem, right? You know, you give the CEO the latest version of Outlook, but he can't get to his mailbox anymore. So a career-limiting move, I believe, is the right technical word for that one. And something that certainly since the days of 2007 has become more apparent is compliance. You know, the whole compliance e-discovery piece has really ramped up over the last few years. And all the investments that we've made to provide solutions for those kind of scenarios and those kind of problems are not in Exchange 2007. Our compliance story is considerably better in newer versions of Exchange and in Exchange Online. And then you also have the fact that Exchange 2007, you know, how many bugs do you think we've fixed since those days? My God, it's a huge amount of money, a huge amount of bugs, right? I mean, you know, we have not just fixed We've fixed and improved and made our code far more efficient over the years. So you've got much better availability, high availability, site resilience, disaster recovery capabilities in all of those newer versions of Exchange. And of course, the hardware that it's running on, you've paid for it, agree, right? Typically, you know, the hardware is no longer a cost element for most organizations if they're still running it, but it doesn't mean the hardware is not going to fail at some point. And do you really want to be doing a recovery of Exchange Server at any point? Not really. You'd rather kind of think about it and get ahead of that curve, typically. That's what you would see. So is moving off Exchange 2007 hard? Well, Exchange migration, frankly, has never been easy. Let's be perfectly honest, okay? It has never been easy. My team have been involved in figuring out and helping figure out the migration strategy from one version of Exchange to another for years. And it's not an easy process. But it's certainly become easier. That is true. With the iterations that we've been through, it has become easier. Who remembers the days of doing in-place upgrades, right? You actually have, you know, the server with a database and you have to run, you know, update, and it modifies that database, and you're kind of sitting there watching this progress bar thinking, please don't fail, please don't fail, please don't fail. I know I've done that. In single server environments, it's terrifying. So we don't have in-place upgrades anymore for a couple of reasons. One is it technically limits us in what we can do in the Exchange store, and there's a bunch of technical capability reasons behind it. But the other was, a much better solution, frankly, is to build a new server and move all the mailboxes across. And when you can do that in a no-impact way, an online move, then the users don't know it's happened and you're away. Okay, it's a much easier solution. So you really have two choices at this stage. You can either stay on-prem, or you can go to the cloud. And I'm going to start with the cloud because this is something is kind of, it struck me once upon a time that this was a really useful way of looking at it. If a customer is running Exchange 2007 today, it generally to me means they're either a very large, slow-moving organization or they have better things to do than worry about IT. Right? And I say, you know, our business is IT as Microsoft. We're in software and hardware. Many companies that are running Exchange 2007 make cupcakes or pencils or, you know, parts for cars. I don't care, right? I mean, but they have more important things to do. IT is not their business. IT is a function that supports their business, and so it kind of slides down the list of priorities sometimes. And that's totally understandable. We totally get that. And so we sometimes kind of overdo the whole IT fanciness of it, right? But try and appreciate and understand that it's not the same for every company. So here's the thing. If you're on Exchange 2007 today, and you go through a hoop to get on Exchange 2016, you'll be here in 10 years' time listening to the "Why am I still on Exchange 2016?" session. And what should I do? Because it isn't a constant thing for you. It's a one-time gig. You want to deal with it, get it out of the way, get on with running your business. And so for that kind of customer, honestly, Exchange Online is almost without doubt the best solution because it gets you out the business of managing servers and updates and versions and all of that good stuff, right? You don't have to worry about it. We manage the upgrades of the servers. There will never be version-to-version big upgrades in Exchange Online because the code on every single server changes about every 2 weeks. We constantly update the server every 2 weeks in every server in Exchange Online. There are hundreds of thousands of servers. But there are no more big bang upgrades. I'm going to move you from version this to version that. It just kind of happens as a constant evolution, as a train. So if you were to make the move from 2007, you'd be straight onto the very latest code and be there forever after, which sounds kind of compelling. So what are your choices if going to the cloud is really where you're going to be going? You've got really two choices if you're going to do a migration yourself. I'm going to talk through a few of these different options. You could either do what we call a cutover or a stage migration, right, which is essentially just picking up your stuff, your users, and your mailboxes and moving them over. If you want to keep some mailboxes on-prem, then you can go into what we call hybrid. You've probably heard Exchange Hybrid. It's a very popular option for a lot of customers that want to keep some mailboxes or some presence on-prem. Another good scenario, a good solution sometimes for if you have a lot of applications on-premises that need to send outbound email, then usually keeping an Exchange server on-prem is quite a good solution for that as well. You can manage objects and just manage users and mailboxes in the cloud, but leave applications to use your on-prem Exchange servers. You can do that quite easily if that's an option. You also get into the case where people say, well, I want to leave my VIPs on-prem and put all my low-value users in the cloud. Hear that quite often. The irony with doing that is that the low-value users get less features than the VIP users. And the VIP users usually find that out and think, why can't I do that? Oh, well, because you're on-prem, because you're a VIP. Well, I want that stuff, because that looks cooler. So, you know, you have to deal with that one too. So you can use a third-party tool. You could hire a partner. We have a ton of great partners who offer migration services, and I'll touch on something that we offer ourselves as well as Microsoft. You can import those PSTs. Who's got a raft of PSTs that they don't know what to do with? I'm sure some of you have. I had a customer once who told all their users, you're not allowed to store PSTs on network drives anymore. So the users dragged and dropped them into public folders instead. I swear that's true. Absolutely crazy. So that was a fun one to figure out. And so you have I've got to put a link in the deck here for you as well. So there's a ways of migrating to Exchange article that we've published on TechNet. And of course, we can do a lot of this for you as well. I'll explain that. So the choices that you have, I'm just going to keep an eye on the clock here because I don't want to make sure we overcook things. It's a bit hard to see how much time we've got. All right. So a cutover or a stage. So this is the two kind of typical examples. If you're going to do this yourself, you're on Exchange 2007, how would you choose which of these approaches to take? Well, this cutover, best for a small organization. And the goal is to get rid of on-prem. The goal is get all your user accounts, get all your mailboxes, move them to the cloud, and just be done with Exchange on-premises. And that's perfectly fine. Now, the technology behind this is Outlook Anywhere. We make a connection from the cloud into your on-premises Exchange 2007 org. So you have to have Outlook Anywhere enabled if it's not already enabled and configured. And if we can walk you through that if you need that. And then Exchange Online makes this connection just as Outlook would. It reads the directory, figures out who's in your organization, creates user accounts in the clouds for you, pulls the data. Okay, it's straightforward and simple, not terribly complex. There will be a period of downtime as you do this switchover, but if it's for an organization of less than 150 seats, you could probably do that over a weekend. Not terribly hard to do yourselves. The other option you've got is a stage migration. So a stage migration, more than 150 users, typically the kind of number. These are not hard and fast numbers. There are no software gates in place to stop you doing this. But typically, this is where you've got a little bit more, you need a bigger window to do this. You can't really do a weekend cutover. You're going to be doing this over a period of time. And the big difference here is that you do directory sync against from your on-premises AD into Office 365. You synchronize your objects, your users, your groups, and your contacts, and so on. You can also do a sync with passwords. So we don't actually send the users' passwords into the cloud. We send a hash of their passwords. So there's some clever technology, actually. It's quite funky the way it's done. So that there's a common hash or a common salt used between on-prem and cloud. We hash the passwords against it. And then the service, Office 365, knows whether your password is right or not by rehashing it and seeing if the values match. We don't actually know what your passwords are, but we know whether the password was correct or not. So then it means that your users can continue to log in with the same password. That's easy. You know, password 123, the one they've been using for the last 10 years, they can carry on using that one just fine. I wouldn't suggest that's a good idea either, but, you know, hey. So, again, we use Outlook Anywhere to extract the data, but this time, rather than creating the user accounts on the fly, we're matching them to the objects that you've synchronized using your directory synchronization process. It's only 2003, 2007 as sources for this. So this is only applicable to those of you in that state, which as we know is many of you here. And then the admin converts those mailboxes on-prem to mail-enabled users on-prem. So they're still accounts that can be logged into, but they don't have a mailbox. They have a target address of your address in Office 365 in Exchange Online. And then when the user logs in, assuming that in that case, AutoDiscover is still pointing to your on-premises world, Outlook gets redirected to the cloud, the profile configures, everyone's off to the races and happy. Okay, pretty straightforward. Now, a couple of diagrams. I'm not going to walk through these. But these are essentially, this is what's documented on TechNet. So there's, in the blue column, it's the things that you're going to be doing in your on-premises environment. And then in the orange column, it's the things that you'll do as an administrator in Office 365. And the column on the right, the black column there, is, you know, the results for users, or on the case on the left, the administrator tasks for changing domains. Honestly, the hardest thing that most people find is all the domain registration and DNS pieces. Migration of mailboxes is really a pretty trivial task, or it should be. And all of these are spelled out for you step by step. This is not a complex process, or is this, let me put it this way. This is a well-proven, well-trodden process followed by many, many customers. Now, hybrid for a second. Touching back on hybrid, what if you want to go hybrid? That means you're going to leave some mailboxes on-prem and you're going to have some mailboxes in the cloud. Well, hybrid has the most comprehensive feature set, giving you that capability to collaborate and continue to coexist between mailboxes on-prem, mailboxes in the cloud. We, as part of the hybrid configuration wizard, which is something that you can run, but you're going to need Exchange 2010 in the organization to make this happen. Just make that clear up front. So if you're pure 2007, you're going to need to add a 2010 or a 2013 server into your environment to configure hybrid. I'd typically go with probably 2013 at that stage, the newest technology that we have or newest available of those choices. And you run the hybrid configuration wizard. Again, there's some DNS prerequisites, certificates perhaps, but fairly straightforward stuff. But when you've configured hybrid, we set up a secure mail flow between your on-premises environment and your Exchange and Exchange Online, meaning that mail that flows between users on-prem and the cloud is secured, authenticated. And what that really does, the end result, is that it looks as though it's internal. So users can email each other, and they are fully resolved recipients in the email. So they don't look like, you know, Fred at, you know, contoso.com. It looks just as Fred, his gal display entry. So you can actually do that, and some users won't even know they've moved. Okay, mail won't show any difference. You have a unified gal, so a global address list. So depending on whether you're on-prem or cloud, the view is the same. You can look up free busy between users who are on-prem and in the cloud. It works just like it does as though they're all on-prem. You can have a single OWA URL, meaning that you can point users, if you publish OWA externally in your on-prem world, users can continue to hit that URL, and then they'll log in, and they'll be redirected to the cloud, and they log in there instead. But they still have to remember the one OWA URL. And there are hybrids. There's plenty of sessions on Exchange Hybrid. There was one first thing this morning, and I think there's another one this afternoon as well, if you are interested in Exchange Hybrid. But you will need to add an updated version of Exchange to your pure 2007 org. So that's one piece that you need to do before you can get to hybrid. So if you can't do cutover or staged, you really do want to end up leaving mailboxes on-prem, hybrid would be the way to go. Now, third-party solutions and partners. So if the idea of doing this is a little bit scary, you don't have the time. It's another good reason for not wanting to do it yourself. There are partners. There are migration tools available, probably down on the expo floor. Pretty sure you'll find them down there as well. And you know, there are plenty of companies out there who have become experts in this migration process and making it as seamless as possible. You know, whenever I used to meet with customers a few years ago and talk about these kind of migrations, you know, I would say my number one goal is that it should be as seamless as possible to the users. If the users don't know they got migrated, then I consider that a success. And another thing about migrations typically is once you start, don't stop. You know, figure out the problems early on, pilot a few users, figure out any wrinkles that are specific to your organization, because everyone has something unique about their environments, you know. Make sure it works for you. Then once you get started, just keep going. Just keep going, because it will be worth it when you get to the end. But if you stop and keep going back, it just gets uglier. From real world experience, I can tell you that's true. Now, what about all those PST files that you might have knocking around, right? Typically coming from older versions of Exchange, people typically have much smaller mailboxes. They have much smaller mailboxes because we were using SAN storage and expensive storage. back in the early days of Exchange, and so mailbox sizes were typically smaller. It was only, as Steve was saying, as we kind of improved our storage technology, we were able to use direct attached storage, JBOD, and storage, cheap storage, which allowed much larger mailboxes. So you typically see a whole bunch of PSTs floating around organizations. Well, you have a couple of choices. You can directly upload them into mailboxes. You can use a network upload option, which is a free option. You can actually upload these PSTs into our cloud and then import that data into those mailboxes. That's one way of doing it. Another way you can do it is you can ship drives as well. You can actually put PSTs on hard drives and send them to us. Now, there is a cost associated with doing that, okay? But it's another option if you're trying to import these PSTs from an area where connectivity is poor. So you have two options in that regard. Now, fast track. Hopefully you've heard the word fast track at some point since you've been at Ignite. Fast track, the onboarding and adoption assistance that we give through the fast track program, is how a huge number of our customers are migrating their stuff to our cloud. Fast track benefits are available to you when you buy Office 365. Depending on the size organization and the number of seats that you buy, depends on whether you just get migration assistance or actual onboarding itself. And there's a team of remote engineers, and depending on the size of the organization, some customers we work with more directly, but the fast track program is there to try and help you as an organization get moving, get these mailboxes migrated, advise you and make sure that what you have on-prem is going to work for you in the cloud. And rather than there are sessions, I think we have a fast track session at the conference as well. I'd encourage you to go to that and see how the Fast Track Center can get you onboarded essentially for free to Office 365. That's another great way of investigating this. You should go figure that one out or go check that one out. So what about some of the other stuff that goes on with on-prem? The public folders and other stuff that you might have floating about. Well, this will be a great chance to really look at the public folders that you have, the ones that are stuffed full of PSTs in my customer's case from a few years ago, and decide, do I really want to bring that to the cloud? Is this an opportunity to leave some of that stuff behind? Microsoft has no public folders anymore. We don't use public folders. We decided as a company, now admittedly, we're not a normal company, right? We do some really crazy stuff and upset our users quite often, but we try and drive things forward. We killed off public folders years ago because unfortunately, we don't give you a great set of tools to figure out which public folders are in use and which aren't and when they were last accessed. I'll hold my hands up to that. But we knew from some basic analysis that we did, looking through folders, that they really weren't being used. And so we basically emailed everyone in the company and said, we're killing public folders. We're going to kill them on this date, tell us if that's a problem. I think we probably posted them in the public folders. That was probably a good idea. And then nobody responded, and we killed them. Job done. Now, I'm not saying that's the same for every organization. Some companies have built massive workflow on their public folder infrastructures. They're core to their business. But you know that if that's the case. If your public folders are there because they're just there, maybe we get rid of them. I know it's a bold kind of thing to do, but if you're going to move forward, you know, don't take all that stuff with you. What about applications? You may have some applications that are integrated into Exchange. Well, a lot of those applications, if they're third-party software that you're buying, may already have a Office 365 capable version of the same product. You may also realize that many of these small add-ins that people on older versions of Exchange have, the add-in capability is now built into the product, right? So you can ditch some of the third-party stuff that you have because Exchange now provides it for you natively. It's cheaper too that way, obviously. But like I said before, it's possible you may want to keep an Exchange server on-prem for certain applications, so there may be some reasons why you need to keep it there. But you know, really think, come on, let's do it. If you're going to do this, let's do a clean break and figure out what we can leave behind. That typically leaves customers with a lot less of things to worry about going forward. So, super important. Keep the clients up to date. This is one piece that I would absolutely tell you as advice from somebody who's seen this cause problems, is Outlook and Auto Discover, or Outlook's behavior, changes with every update and version. We fix stuff. It's been over the last probably 6 months to a year, I'd say I've seen less issues. But you know, with Outlook, early versions of Outlook 2016 and 2013, there were bugs and problems that customers would find, particularly as we switched from Outlook Anywhere to Mappy HTTP, which is the new way Outlook connects to the service, or to Exchange, newer versions of Exchange. There was plenty of opportunities there for things that went wrong, and we fixed a ton of bugs. So quite often, people would call in with a connectivity issue, and it's, are you running the latest version of Outlook? Well, no. Well, why don't you try the latest version of Outlook? Oh, look, my problem's gone away. Genuinely, to keep the clients up to date, hugely useful. Yeah. Don't let that automatic upgrade to Exchange 2016 break connectivity. I mentioned that one earlier. Outlook 2016 can't connect to Exchange 2007. Security policies, another one I'll throw out there. So I see this one as well, which is that the IT security department, and I love a good fight with the IT security department people. I have so much fun with those, right? But they need to, it's a different shift if you're going to the cloud. It's a whole different kind of security mindsets needed. If they're still thinking in on-prem terms, then moving to the cloud will just be hard. They will make it hard for you. But security in a cloud world is a little bit different than security in an on-prem world. Now, there's plenty of resources out there available to help, but you need to try and elevate the discussion into how other companies are working in against the cloud, you know, if the competitors, and why is it they can do this and why we can't? You know, particularly I find as well, involving the business decision makers rather than the security decision makers in the process. We as a company want to move and adopt this technology because we think it will bring advances and benefits to our company, but these guys are saying we should lock the server in a closet, take out the network cable and lock the door, right? That's a security policy approach sometimes. So you need to change the discussion a little bit. And your role, if you're an IT an administrator, an Exchange admin, it's not about you losing your role. Your role is changing. You're not managing servers, you're managing a service. And frankly, managing servers isn't terribly interesting. I mean, when all the lights are blinking green, that's all great. When the lights blink orange, it's like, oh crap, what am I going to do now, right? Manage a service, don't manage servers. There's still plenty to do. So what if you do want to stay on-prem? I'm kidding, of course you can. Right, so you can add 2013 if you're an Exchange 2007 customer into your organization. First things you'd want to do would be upgrade Exchange 2007 to the latest service pack and roll up. Always a good idea. You should always be running the latest stuff that we release, genuinely. You need to consider a bunch of stuff, though. You've got namespaces, certificates, proxying, legacy namespaces. There are some complexities. It's well documented. But the move from 2007 to 2013 is a fairly complex operation. There are things to consider, and so you need to work through that methodically. And the basic principle is you front-end everything with Exchange 2013, or the newest version of Exchange, and so the clients connect through Exchange 2013 and authenticate. If they're still on 2007 and they're using OWA, they get redirected. If they're using Outlook, they can connect through. There's a bunch of different connectivity scenarios depending on the client that's in use. But the basic idea is you move everyone to talk to the newest version of Exchange at the front door and then let that figure out what they should do from there. Then you move mailboxes, and these are online moves. So you can move the CEO's 25 gig mailbox from one server to another, and it's only right at the end when the actual completion takes place that he'll be temporarily locked out of the mailbox while we finalize everything and then reconnected. So they can be online. Users can be online. You can move mailboxes. We move mailboxes around in Exchange Online constantly. I mean, mailboxes are moving constantly all over the place to balance capacity requirements and all of that stuff. Do people notice? Not really. They don't. We do it all the time. Once you're done, public folders. You have to leave the public folders to the end. And so once all the users have moved their mailboxes to the newest version, you come back and you move the public folders, or you get rid of the public folders. There's your opportunity to do so. Okay? What would a move to 2010 look like? Well, you shouldn't, if you're on 2007 today, don't move to Exchange 2010. I mean, that would be kind of nuts. Seriously? I know a couple of large organizations that takes them years to make a decision. They move like glaciers, right? But this would be a kind of stupid move, frankly, for most organizations, because you're already moving to something that is way, way, way out of date. And I see some smiling over there, which means you're doing it or something, right? I hope not. Please don't. You should definitely get to 2013 as a minimum on-prem. And then the question then is, what do you want to do from there? Because you're already on an old version of our product. You've gone through that migration, and you're not even current. What do you do then? Well, you can move to 2016 straight away. And the nice thing is that the hard work it took you to get from 2007 to 2013, the jump from 13 to 16 is trivial by comparison, really trivial. And as Steve said, actually, that you can front end, you don't have to move. Everyone's connecting through Exchange 2013. You could add 2016 mailbox servers and move mailboxes to it without having to change how people connect, all the connectivity. Exchange 2013 can up version proxy to 2016, which is a great thing. It makes migration a whole lot easier. So really, once you know, it is a double hop migration, but if you consider the, you know, a line of complexity from 0 to 100, 95% of that is 2007 to 13, 5% would be 13 to 16. So you might just want to consider that an additional task once you get to the end of, once you get rid of your last 2007 mailbox servers. You move your mailboxes, load balancer, you switch over gradually or all at once. I mean, you know, we have plenty of customers who do big bang migrations with that. Then you're on 2016. Sounds easy, doesn't it? I know for some organizations it's a bit harder than that, but it's probably not as hard as you might think. So last words of advice on an actual migration. So like I said before, keep clients up to date. It is hugely important, particularly you're connecting to our online service. Out-of-date clients are a real primary reason why people have connectivity issues. So that would be one. Make sure the clients are up to date. And I've put some links in here too. There's some general guidance on the migration. The deployment assistant, if you're deploying Exchange on-prem, the deployment assistant's a terrific tool to ask what you've got today, where is it you're going to go, and what are the steps you need to follow. So the expanded version of these things that I've mentioned with detail and links to additional information, that's where you should go. And our latest sizing guidance. So if you're going to build Exchange 2013 or 2016 servers, don't go out and buy the biggest honking server that your hardware vendor will sell you, because they will sell you the biggest hardware they can sell you, because that's the business they're in, and that's okay. But if you go and buy that, and typically these days it's like, I'm going to buy 48 cores and, you know, 256 gig of RAM, and then you try and install Exchange 2016 on it, it won't work very well. And I know that won't work very well from personal experience, having seen customers who've built those kind of servers. Our guidance is 20 cores, 96 gig of RAM. Now, that may change, and it will change. We talked about it at this conference earlier. It will change as we roll bigger hardware into Exchange Online and prove it out. But our goal is about the Exchange engineering team's kind of driver is to try and make it low cost. We want low cost hardware, commodity hardware. Exchange has been developed to run on commodity cheap hardware, direct attached storage, cheap disks, cheap commodity hardware. If you're gonna buy these honking great servers, you might end up looking at virtualization to effectively use them. And that has its additional complexity elements to it, okay? Stick to something we call the preferred architecture. If you're not familiar with that, then take a look at the link. The preferred architecture is essentially building Exchange the same way we deploy Exchange in the service. The closer you stick to what we do, the more predictable your Exchange deployment will be. If you want to get kind of crazy and start building some random stuff, you may have some random and crazy results. If you stick to what we do, we know it works. And you can assure yourself certainly the most reliable and repeatable experience. All right, so we're just under 2 minutes to go. So I had to go a bit fast there because, you know, the marketing guy, he took some time early on, so I've had to catch up a bit. All right, I hope that wasn't too fast. But so you have a choice, right? Cloud or on-prem, it is your choice. I'm not personally somebody who says your only option is cloud. There are plenty of good reasons why I have customers tell me that they need to stay on-prem, and I'm good with that. But what I want you to do if you're going to stay on-prem is get up to date. Because being up to date, you're going to get our best set of features, our best, you know, the biggest number of bug fixes, the best security and the best compliance and all of that stuff. Plus, if and when you decide you want to go to the cloud, your transition will be simple. The longer you leave the old technology lying around, the harder your transition will be when you decide to do it. Maybe it's the next guy's problem after your job, you know, after you've gone, you leave it for somebody else to figure out, but he won't thank you for it, or he or she won't thank you for it, I can promise you that. It'll be a toughie. So that pretty much, I think, covers us up, Steve.
One point about the preferred architecture.
Yes, sir.
In 30 minutes in the Georgia Ballroom, we have a session. On the preferred architecture. Russ Smith from Greg's team, who is the Jedi Master of Exchange 2016 deployments, and a guest speaker from General Motors, who is one of our largest on-premises customers. They're running Exchange 2016 on-premises with the preferred architecture. You'll hear a little bit about their experience and how it's worked for them. So if you're interested in that, I know we talked a lot about online here. That's a great drill down session into on-premises. We've also got an installing 2016 session tomorrow. So if you want to learn about just putting it on the metal on your own hardware, great session from Brian Day, also from Greg's team tomorrow.
That's right. See, we're here in force. All right, so please don't forget to fill out an eval. I hope it was useful for those 2007. Get moving. Feel free to come and ask us questions after the session ends. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.